Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Supreme Court of the United States ruled on the following cases today. Whether the Clean Water Act trumps the Endangered Species Act. It does. When interest groups can air political issue ads. Almost whenever they want. Also, what to do about bong hits for Jesus. Now, guess which one of those we're going to cover. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday today, June 25th. Glad you could be with us. Bong hits, sadly, will have to wait for another day, unless you find it easier to talk about campaign finance that way. Somehow, though, we doubt that's the case with the members of the Supreme Court. Today, the justices substantially relaxed a key restriction on political advertising, specifically ads that run in the last weeks before an election. So if you think you're seeing too many of them now, hang on to your hats, because there are no spending limits either. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The court decided the McCain-Feingold ban on privately funded issue ads during the final weeks before an election or primary violated the advertiser's right to free speech. The decision was cheered by advocacy groups from the National Rifle Association to the ACLU, as well as business groups and labor unions. Lawrence Gold is a lawyer for the AFL-CIO.
It really isn't the government's role to tell organizations when they can speak and what they can talk about.
But supporters of limits on money in politics said they were deeply disappointed. Bob Edgar is the president of Common Cause.
I think this decision will mark the return of millions of dollars of unregulated special interest money funding scam political ads over and over again right before elections.
In his majority opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote, where the First Amendment is implicated, the tie goes to the speaker, not the censor. That's especially good news for the chief counsel of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Stephen Law, who's anticipating challenges of state laws that limit election-related issue ads.
We think that overall what this portends is an environment in the Supreme Court that is a lot more hospitable to free speech and to people who want to petition their government.
This ruling leaves in place prohibitions on corporate or union-funded campaign ads in the final weeks before an election. However, some opponents of that ban say the court's endorsement of free speech rights for issue ads gives them an opening to challenge the campaign ad restriction. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
There was a small tremor of political compromise from Tehran today. The Iranians are under pressure to stop enriching uranium, so they invited a team from the International Atomic Energy Agency to come visit. It's just the latest development in the continuing international disagreement over tougher economic sanctions. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
The Iranian government has invited officials from the UN's nuclear agency to come to Tehran for talks. The object, say the Iranians, to get to the bottom of the issues. Don't get your hopes up, says Cliff Kupchan of the Eurasia Group.
There is no Iranian offer to suspend uranium enrichment. Until we see progress on that issue from Tehran, there's no light at the end of the tunnel.
He says that the Iranians are simply playing for time. It's a casual, conciliatory gesture, he says. They're not that worried about the possibility of stiffer economic sanctions from the UN. They're right not to be worried, says David Butter of the Economist Intelligence Unit.
I don't think we're going to see any all-embracing trade sanctions anytime soon because of the difficulty of getting an international consensus on that.
The Chinese don't want to upset a major oil producer. The Russians are too keen to sell the Iranians nuclear technology. The existing sanctions against Tehran are relatively mild. There's a ban on international dealings with 24 Iranian individuals and organizations. Rula Khalaf is Middle East editor of the Financial Times.
They make it more difficult for businessmen in Iran. They complicate trade, they complicate finance, but not to the point where they're likely to change policy.
Some analysts say the Iranians will probably have mastered the basics of nuclear technology by early next year and, according to some estimates, will be able to build a crude nuclear weapon by the middle of 2009. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Investors had and gave away 120 points on the Dow today. Still, though, only wound up down a little bit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The undercurrent running through the stock market today was uncertainty, especially about the housing market. There's talk Bear Stearns will have to borrow maybe $10 billion to keep its troubled hedge funds afloat. They and a bunch of other funds are buried in subprime mortgage problems. And on top of that, we learned this morning we've got the biggest overhang of unsold houses in this country in the past 15 years, and sales are still sliding. Commentator John Authors points out that some of Wall Street's banks are warning their clients about rising economic inequality. He says it's about time.
The rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And that could be a problem for the rich. That's not an original observation. It goes back at least as far as Karl Marx, who talked of two great hostile camps that could sort out their differences either through revolution or in the common ruin of the contending classes. Nobody on Wall Street is advocating revolution. But if UBS, the biggest bank in Switzerland, can say it finds that low-income Americans have been in a recession all this century, that says something. UBS believes that inequality is a deepening problem for everyone, and not just the poor. And Wall Street is right to be worried. First of all, it makes the job of investing harder. That's because numbers on the aggregate economy become meaningless when you have two separate economies, one built around the rich and the other around the poor. So good luck on deciding where to put your money. If you want to lend, look no further than the subprime mortgage debacle. The headlines show the US economy barely slowing down, and yet the subprime mortgage industry is in crisis. The theory is that diversification will look after you. Mortgages and other loans are now packaged up and sold on as securities. If you buy a security representing a range of mortgages, defaults should stay at a manageable rate. But that assumes all borrowers are living in the same economy. If they are living in two, one of which is in crisis, such comfortable assumptions go out of the window. And if you want to invest, luxury goods are a good investment, but there is a limit as to how many of those goods the rich will buy. Selling to the increasingly poorer economy looks risky. Marx said that inequality could be a problem for everyone. He proposed his own solution, which would certainly not go down well with the wealthy. But remember, his other option was common ruin. Wall Street is taking that more seriously than you'd think.
John Authors is the investment editor at the Financial Times. Take a moment to send us your thoughts. The website is marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on the link that says contact. On the face of it, China's a capitalist's dream, a huge and increasingly wealthy market to sell into, and an almost bottomless pool of cheap labor. Of course, it comes with the opportunity to get really clobbered in ways that a foreign company might not necessarily be thinking of. Elizabeth Economy writes about one of them, the environment, in the June issue of the Harvard Business Review. Good to have you with us.
Thanks very much.
So hit the highlights for me, the big issues that companies ought to be thinking about in regard to the environment in China and that they are not.
Many multinationals at this point do realize that China, for example, faces very scarce water resources. But I think beyond that, what's happening in China is really a grassroots movement to hold multinationals accountable for much of the pollution challenge that China today faces, what they're doing with their water resources, how their factories down the supply chain might be polluting the air, polluting the water. So it's a huge emerging challenge for multinationals as they start to think about what kind of operation they want to run in China.
All right, well, let's pretend for a second you've decided to leave the Council on Foreign Relations and become an international business consultant. What are the first three or four things you're going to tell them to do?
Above all, they need to be very proactive. So whatever kind of industry they're in, they need to make sure that all of their equipment, all of their technology is top of the line, because the Chinese are extremely sensitive to the idea that other countries and other companies are offloading lesser technology into China. Second, China gives a lot of points for doing the right thing when it comes to the environment. So one way to earn favor is to become engaged in environmental good works. And last but not least, you need to work at every level of the government. And that means working at the local level. And it means really, from the outset, talking to China's environmental NGO activists. All of these people are watching multinationals to ensure that they're trying to do the right thing environmentally.
China is, in maybe the truest sense of the word, a political economy. That is to say, the government and some of these businesses are very closely intertwined, which sometimes puts multinationals at a competitive disadvantage in this regard.
Absolutely. And one of the things, for example, in the case of a wind power firm that thought it had an agreement to establish a wind power farm in China, in the southern part of China, worked for 2 years, provided the intellectual property information for all the wind measurements to the local county and provincial government. And after 2 years, when it was ready to begin development of the project, was told by the local government, actually, we've decided to grant this concession to a Chinese firm. And by the way, you know, all the information that you've provided, all that intellectual property is now lost. And the firm has decided not to sue because it doesn't feel that it has a chance of winning in court because of precisely what you mentioned, the connections between the party officials, the local businesses, and in fact, the party within the court system.
When you talk to people in the Chinese government about this issue, what do they say when you bring up the point of, you know, it's going to impact China's gross domestic product in a not positive way if we don't get these environmental things under control. And multinationals, for all the problems they might bring you, are certainly bringing some benefits as well.
There's no doubt that both Chinese environmental officials and Chinese NGO, environmental NGO activists, recognize that by and large, multinationals are trying to do the right thing when it comes to the environment in China. Nonetheless, they look out at China, this vast sea of environmental challenges, and they really want these multinationals to bear the brunt of the cost of it by sort of shaming and naming the factories that source to these multinationals first. I think that they can make a good start in environmental cleanup because they know that these multinationals can't stand that kind of bad publicity.
Elizabeth Economy is the Director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Her article on the environmental risks and rewards of doing business in China is in the current issue of the Harvard Business Review. Dr. Economy, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, running Rite Aid.
In this business, you win neighborhood by neighborhood. So you don't have to have the most pharmacies, and you don't have to be the biggest pharmacy.
Another conversation from the corner office, but first, let's do the numbers. Stocks were riding high earlier in the day on lower oil prices and not so happy, but anticipated housing numbers. But worries about a gathering storm around subprime mortgages took the wind out of the markets pretty fast. The Dow Industrials fell 8 points, just a fraction, to close at 13,352. The NASDAQ fell 11 points, about a half a percent, to 2577. The S&P 500 slid 4 points, a third of 1%, to 1497. Bear Stearns, which, as you might know, has two hedge funds invested heavily in subprimes, it fell 3.25%. Investors got nervous when analysts said the company may not have seen the last of its mortgage woes yet. Also caught in the receding tide was Goldman Sachs. Its shares fell 2.5%. Bond prices gained. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note dropped to 5.08%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management, also sponsoring PBS's CEO Exchange, shrm.org. Ever hear a song on Marketplace but you just can't place it?
Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to an online store where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. The Commerce Department releases its report on sales of new homes for the month of May. A Senate committee holds a hearing on protecting homebuyers from abusive mortgage practices. And it's the United Nations International Day in Support of Victims of Torture. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Regulations that cover commodities exchanges are, of necessity, complicated. It takes more than just a couple of rules to rein in unrestrained capitalism. But with complicated rules come sophisticated loopholes. A hedge fund known as Amaranth Advisors fell apart last September after making some bad bets on natural gas futures. At a hearing in Washington today, Senate investigators said Amaranth left customers and the entire natural gas industry paying higher prices, and that it was completely legal. Jeremy Hobson has more from Washington.
Amaranth took advantage of what's called the Enron loophole. It was slipped into an appropriations bill in 2000 at the request of Enron lobbyists. The loophole keeps over-the-counter electronic exchanges free from most federal oversight. It allowed Amaranth to trade energy futures largely outside the control of regulators.
I don't think for a huge chunk of the market that there are any cops on the beat. Where are the cops?
That's the question Sean Cota asked at today's hearing. He's the president of the New England Fuel Institute. He and other industry leaders said when Amaranth bet on higher futures prices, natural gas providers were hit with higher costs. They passed those costs along to consumers. Senator Carl Levin chairs the subcommittee that held today's hearing.
It's one thing when speculators gamble with their own money. It's another when they turn U.S. energy markets into a lottery, where everybody is forced to gamble with them.
Amaranth, which collapsed, clearly lost its gamble, but because it wielded so much control over the market, senators say its trading practices should have been regulated. There are concerns about that idea. Carnegie Mellon economics professor Adam Larick says Congress is overreacting and that any regulation would be futile.
If you attempt to just regulate specific markets, then the trading is going to migrate elsewhere.
Congress has tried to close the Enron loophole before, unsuccessfully. Supporters of regulation hope a series of hearings on Amaranth will revive the issue and give it another chance. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, the House Financial Services Committee takes up proposed changes to Sarbanes-Oxley. That's the corporate reform law prompted by scandals at Enron and WorldCom. There's been a lot of talk lately from CEOs and regulators alike about how complying with SARBOX, or SOX sometimes, is tedious and costly. But some companies are leveraging that burden into a financial boon. From WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch reports.
Okay. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's 7:30 in the morning, and Bruce Bisanko is meeting with his auditing team. He is the chief financial officer, or CFO, for Yankee Candle Company. Bisanko wants to know how his staff is keeping up with the strict financial reporting schedule of Sarbanes-Oxley.
Dennis, anything else?
Not right now, no.
Okay. Dave?
Key priority from my perspective is to get that 404 scoping document finalized with Lou and through you guys.
Sarbanes-Oxley, or SOX, was designed to restore investor confidence in the stock market. A lot of CFOs said, thanks a lot, Enron. Look at all the extra work we have to do now. But at Yankee Candle, Bisanko jumped at the chance to use SOX to his advantage. Perhaps one of the biggest benefits came from having to detail every little step in the accounting process. Now Bisanko says it's easier for new hires to fit right in.
Talk about competitive advantage. We have a competitive advantage in some sense in the ability to move people around into these different jobs and to progress from a career perspective that might not otherwise have been the case.
And Yankee was also able to get rid of a lot of inefficiencies in its accounting, even basic things like having to get far too many signatures for trivial stuff. And it gave the company a better sense of its cash flow and expenses, information that helped it do a better job of setting priorities. So you might be thinking, why wasn't Yankee Candle doing this before SOX? Well, because most companies put money into tangible things. Take Yankee's production plant up the road from Bisanko's office. glass jars rattle down a conveyor belt to be filled with fresh-smelling forest green wax. Companies invest in automated systems like this because it's easy to see the cost-cutting at work. Practically, that's not the case with less tangible things like accounting. Yankee CFO Bruce Bisanko credits SOX for bringing the financials into focus.
It would have been very difficult to have provided those resources to get that done in the absence of a regulatory requirement, no question.
If you have better internal controls, you're going to have better information.
Ryan LaFond is an MIT professor.
And one of the fundamental inputs to an investment decision, to an operating decision, is information.
LaFond and other researchers showed that companies that follow SOX lower their so-called cost of capital. Basically, that means investors feel more confident about these companies. LaFond says they're rewarding better reporting by putting their money into them.
Maybe it's just my impression, but I think you definitely see this kind of, oh, we got to roll back SOX, and oh, SOX has been so bad for the competitiveness of the U.S. capital market. And I just don't see where, you know, the evidence for that is coming from.
Certainly not from Yankee Candle. The company paid $300,000 up front to comply with SOX and now pays about an extra $200,000 a year just to keep up with reporting. But CFO Bruce Bisanko says Yankees saved much more through better accounting and earning investor confidence.
We're competing and we want to win. And we looked at and continue to look at these compliance issues as ways to win in the competitive marketplace.
In South Deerfield, Massachusetts, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
Before there was Enron, there was Rite Aid. In 1999, the drugstore chain was caught in a $1.6 billion accounting train wreck and teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. The top brass were fired. Some of them wound up as long-term guests of the federal government. And a woman named Mary Sammons was hired as the president and chief operating officer.
The boss will see you now.
Sammons has been promoted. She's chairman and CEO now, and by most measures, she's brought Rite Aid back from the brink. Earlier this month, she closed a $4 billion deal to buy the Brooks and Eckerd chains. For this month's edition of Conversations from the Corner Office, we went to Rite Aid headquarters in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where I asked Sammons about the early days.
I tell you, in the beginning, it was almost a day by day. One of the things that we did right away is set out what the plan would be, like when we would start some remodels, when we would address different supplier issues. Some of the things I couldn't do as fast as I wanted to. If there wasn't enough money to get something started this week, then I looked again the next week. I spent a lot of that early time talking to our people, going out to stores, talking to our suppliers so that they gained confidence in shipping us again, because that was a big issue.
They weren't shipping you their product?
No. When I got here, we were grossly out of stock. We had suppliers that had us on credit hold. There were a lot of antagonistic relationships that had been that were a result of what former management had done. And so we spent a lot of time meeting with suppliers to really talk to them about who we were and what we were going to be doing to regain their credibility, that they could trust us. And we got the stores filled with product again. That made our people feel better, too. You know, nothing worse than being in a store and not having product to sell.
When you went out to those stores, what were your employees telling you? I mean, it must have been, as tough as it was for you, it must have been brutal for them.
It was. I mean, they were so demoralized and very concerned about their future and the future of the company. And we spent that time listening and then started doing the things that they said mattered, even at a big cost to us.
So perception in some ways is as important as anything else.
Absolutely. I mean, if people believe that you are going to do the right things and going to listen to them, that word travels so fast. And then all of a sudden you've got your 75,000 associates all believing that, yeah, we can make this happen.
Most CEOs in this country probably think twice when they sign on the dotted line for their annual reports and quarterly statements in the wake of Enron and Sarbanes-Oxley accountability requirements. Nobody probably more so than you, having come into this company in the wake of a huge accounting scandal. When you sign on that statement, what are you thinking about?
I have extraordinary level of confidence in our whole financial group here. Now, a lot of it comes from the fact we had to go through the massive restatement we did back in the 2000-2001 time period. It was probably the biggest news out there in notoriety. And so we had to get everything, if squeaky clean is the right term, that's it. So when I sign, I don't worry about what I'm signing.
What are your thoughts on Sarbanes-Oxley? Do you think it's gone too far? Is it onerous, or do you think it's just right?
It might be a little too onerous, but I think it's good for business. I mean, it may have gone maybe to an extreme in the kinds of things that, you know, you're required to do, but I think it keeps everybody very focused on keeping integrity at the highest level in companies, and, you know, that should be important to shareholders.
How are you going to grow this company now? There aren't too many other big chains out there that you can go and buy, and yet there's a population that's aging that's going to need more medicine and more healthcare. What are you going to do to meet that demand and maximize Rite Aid's profits?
Well, we're going to keep adding new stores, too. We fully intend to add about 1,000 new stores over the next 5 years, in addition to what we are digesting with the stores we just got. And that's important because there are neighborhoods that we aren't in. In this business, you win neighborhood by neighborhood. So you don't have to have the most pharmacies, and you don't have to be the biggest pharmacy. If you can be the best pharmacy in the neighborhoods where you're serving customers, then you can keep growing your business because you're going to get that loyalty of that customer, and then they advertise for you.
Pick one word, just one, to describe your management style.
One word. Jeez. That's a tough question. Persistent.
Mary Sammons is the chairman, CEO, and president of Rite Aid. You can hear more of our talk and conversations from other corner offices on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, a question to leave you with today. MySpace or Facebook? Which one do you prefer? Your answer might actually say more about your economic status than your online habits. According to research out from the University of California, Berkeley, Facebook users tend to be more educated than their MySpace counterparts. Of course, part of that's because Facebook only recently opened its membership to all users, not just those with email addresses from academic institutions. Still, Facebook is growing, which could say something about the smarts of new social networkers, or more likely still, the smarts of the company. And that's Marketplace from a company called American Public Media. Today, the Dow down 8 points, less than a tenth percent. The Nasdaq dropped 11 points, about a half a percent. The S&P 500 gave up almost 5 points, about a third of 1% there. Our producers include Megan Larson and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time, new techniques for snuffing out the fire.
But you saw again how quickly, when you remove that flame, within a matter of what was probably a second or so, that fire went out.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.